Can you please tell me what sort of musical activities you were involved in before you formed the Mothers?
I had a recording studio in Cucamonga, California.
Was this a sort of private thing?
No, it was supposed to be, open to the public, and I was going studio time, but there was nobody out there who wanted to make records.
So you never made any masters up there?
Well, I made a lot of masters, but I didn't make masters of other people, people coming in off the street to use it as a commercial studio. Most of the masters that came out of it were either of overdub things that I'd made myself or tracks involving Ray Collins, who was the original lead singer from the group. Yeah. Before we actually had a group, I was working with him. I produced some stuff on him.
Yeah, none of it was ever issued.
Well, no. I took the masters to town and shopped them around, and nobody picked up on them. However, before I owned the studio, the guy who had it before me was a guy named Paul Buff. Mm. And he had made masters of both Ray Collins and myself.
Yeah.
And some of those were issued.
Yeah, I think Bob Keane put out.
Yeah.
One on Delphi, I think.
Yeah, there's one called How's Your Bird and The World's Greatest Sinner on the other side.
Yeah.
And also, I made some tracks and wrote some material for a couple of other acts at that time. One of them was released on Delphi with a group called the Heartbreakers. It was two 14-year-old Mexican kids who sang. One side was called Cradle Rock, and the other side was Every Time I See You, or something like that. I can't remember what the name was.
Yeah.
And we also leased a couple of masters to Art LeBeau at Original Sound.
Yeah, who was that by?
One of them was called Mr. Clean, by Mr. Clean, and the other one was Grunion Run, which was released under the name of the Hollywood Persuaders. The A side of Grunion Run was Tijuana Surf, which became the number one record in Mexico for about 10 months straight and sold volumes down there.
That was yourself and Ray?
No, that was Grunion Run was me and Paul Buff. And then Ray and I wrote a song called Memories of El Monte, which was recorded by the Penguins, and that was released on Original Sound.
There's not nothing else before that?
There were a couple of releases on a extremely low budget label. Okay. The label was called Viga, V-I-G-A-H. And there was several things out on that. One of them, the first record I ever made was called Break Time.
Yeah.
By a group called The Masters, which was me and Paul Buff and Ronnie Williams, who was playing drums and bass on a thing. It was an overdub deal. And then the next...
What date was that about?
Oh, that was 62 or 63. See what else we have. We made a record with a local disc jockey from San Bernardino named Brian Lord, who could do a Kennedy imitation. And we recorded a record called The Big Surfer.
Yeah.
Which had a very strange punchline to it, and we took it in. We had released it on Viga, and it was getting a lot of play in San Bernardino because the cat was a disc jockey. So we took it into Capitol and offered it to them, and they bought the master right away. They gave us $800 in front for it.
Who was that that bought it?
Jim Economides. And they never released it because one of the lines in there had something about for winning our dance contest, you get to be the first members of the Peace Corps to be sent to Alabama. And about a week after they bought the master, Medgar Evers got shot. So, I mean, it was just too hot to release it.
Where was this Viga or Vega label based? In San Bernardino?
No, Viga was just a name that we cooked up for the stuff that was made there in Cucamonga.
And it was your label? You should.
No, it was Paul Buff's label, because he owned the studio at that time. I was just a creep that used to hang around there. And we also recorded a parody of Paul and Paula called Ned and Nelda, which was one side was Ned and Nelda and the other side was Surf Along with Ned and Nelda.
It's amazing, this sort of comedy satirical.
Yeah.
Bang, you were in there.
Yeah.
Even that idea, I guess.
Yeah, well, even before that, because prior to the time I had access to a recording studio, I would rent tape recorders from a local hi-fi shop on the weekends, and you know, for about $5 for a weekend, I'd have all my friends over to the house and we'd improvise plays and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a lot of those tapes.
You should put them out, yeah.
I wish I could. I can't, don't know whether there's really a market for some of that kind of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did research where I would interview people and get their life stories. Some of the most grotesque events of the century.
Like, what's the thing?
Well, the story of Ronnie and Kenny. Like, Kenny saved his piss in these mason jars out in back of his house until black things started growing in it.
Yeah.
It got increased in size and swam around in the jars, and no doctor knew what it was.
Right.
And his brother Ronnie, who saved his snot on a window in his room.
Yeah.
I have them telling about these things. And
what are these, just local?
There were kids who lived in Ontario. Ronnie was the guitar player on the first record.
Wow.
You know, they're just, if I met somebody and they looked like they had a story to tell, I would just say, here.
And this guy had black things.
Yeah.
About.
You want to hear him tell about?
Yeah, that's really weird.
What
were they?
I don't know. But at one time, we had delivered to Bob Keane masters for, you know the album Lumpy Gravy?
Yeah.
You know the last tune on Lumpy Gravy goes da 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 da, and a little bongo fill and da 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 da. It's called Take Your Clothes Off When You Dance, and when it's in the We're Only at the Money album. Well, we took that very same master that's on Lumpy Gravy because it was recorded in 62 or 63. Yeah, and took it to him, and he sat on it and never released it when he got it back. And I would play you some of the tapes of the actual production that we did with Ray at the studio, because some of them are quite remarkable.
Mm.
The tunes, there's three or four tunes on the Reuben and the Jets album that were originally recorded in Cucamonga.
Okay.
And then we re-recorded them for the Reuben and the Jets thing.
But by the time you re-recorded them, they were in fact dated. Yeah, they were parodies. But originally, they were the real thing, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, except that, no...
Because I hadn't heard them, the original. Yeah.
Well, the original era of that sort of music, which, you know, Greaseball, ooh-wah...
That like, came back right back then, yeah.
That's 55 and 56, and it would have been like a revival material to have done it in 62 or 63.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see if I can find some of those. Who and what were your influences in your formative years?
For what?
Well, musically speaking.
Most in high school was rhythm and blues.
Mm.
And I like Johnny Guitar Watson and Clarence Gatemouth Brown and Lightning Slim, Muddy Waters and the Howlin' Wolf and all the group vocals.
Mm.
And the first classical or serious music record I ever had was The Complete Works of Edgar Varese, Volume 1. And the second album that I had was a cheapo release of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky. And I listened to those two albums for about 2 years before I owned any others. And I liked them equally as well as the rhythm and blues. So my whole background is like just those elements.
When you say rhythm and blues, was this an exception? In those days, for a white kid to listen to.
Yeah, it was.
Watson, were you considered sort of pervert almost? Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it was
so far out that anybody should listen to Johnny Guitar Watson because nobody knew who he was. I mean, you know, there was nobody that you could discuss Johnny Guitar Watson with.
This is in Baltimore.
No, this was in Lancaster, California. That's where I met Beefheart.
That's in the mid-50s.
Yeah. See, I was first turned on to that kind of music when I was living in San Diego. I lived in San Diego in 54 and 55, and I used to know a lot of vicious teenage hoodlum type characters who identified very strongly with that sort of music, because not only did the lyric content match their lifestyle, but the overall timbre of the music seemed to express the way they felt, you know. And it sort of got my stamp of approval too. So I just went out collecting every one of those kind of records that I could find.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved to Lancaster, I couldn't find them anymore. There was no record store up there that had it. You know, that was mostly like a cowboy area. And the closest that you could get to any kind of rock and roll was Elvis Presley, and I wasn't going for that. So I got a job in a record store.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the buyer for the store. and I worked there in my lunch hours and after school.
Mm.
And I ran a campaign to upgrade the musical taste of the community by importing such records as Tell Me Darling by the Gay Larks.
Mm.
And I sold an enormous quantity of Oh What a Night by the Dells. And I've managed to get a quantity of reissues of Behind the Sun by the Rocking Brothers
mm.
on Imperial. It was, I think it was originally recorded on R&B, but mm. it had been off, hadn't been manufactured for a long time. We kept sending in requests for it and getting NA not available reports back on. And finally, we got 10 of them in the store.
Yeah,
that was. Oh, it was a landslide event.
And what were people buying before you started trying to convert?
Roy, yeah, well, no, Tequila was later than that. Roy Orbison and Elvis Presley and Bill Haley. You know, really white, corny type stuff.
Mm.
And then I made a discovery that you could score heavy in the jukebox record department. And there was a cheap dime store up there called the Gilbert's Dime Store.
Mm.
And Mr. Gilbert used to get in these jukebox records and
yeah.
put them in the rack for a few cents a piece, you know.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what he would just get a bulk shipment from some guy that would send him in. And it was just crawling with Excello releases,
mm-hmm.
and which is really a fine because Excello has a policy where they wouldn't let you carry their line in a store unless you took their gospel stuff along with it,
mm-hmm.
and unless you had a strong black market in your shop, it wasn't going to pay you to take that line. So if you wanted to get Lightning Slim or Slim Harpo,
you had to stock the whole thing.
Yeah. So I used to score all my rural blues from the dime store, and then periodically I would make trips down to San Diego to a place called the Maryland Hotel
mm.
that had a jukebox record store in the one corner of it, and we'd go in there and rip off records.
mm. Well, did you have any groups at that time? I mean, sort of street corner groups, you know, were you in any of those?
Well,
there was this group on that tape that you just played.
Oh, you mean musical groups?
Yeah, vocal groups. Were you involved in that?
No, because I wasn't much of a singer. And
what was that group on that tape that guy mentioned, the Velvetones?
Velvetones?
Shrine.
Yeah, well, we worked a benefit at the Shrine Auditorium for the NAACP when I was in high school.
Mm.
And we were the warm-up band for Earl Bostick.
Mm.
And
you're all white kids?
No, we had a mixed group. Mm. I had let's see, it was about an eight-piece group. One guy was half Sicilian and half Indian. We had two Mexicans, and me and one other guy were the whiteys in the band, and all the rest of the guys were black.
What was the band called?
The Blackouts.
Oh, that's right.
And our band uniform was white peggers with these metal belts that were used as chains in case of eruptive disturbances after the gig. And brown plaid shirts, and we had another band shirt, which was dark blue lamé. Very exotic. In fact, most of what we earned went to buy uniforms. Nobody
yeah.
ever really cleared anything.
That's the most important thing, I guess.
Well, you know, if you wanted to belong to something, you had your choice. You had ROTC at school, you know. Reserve Officers Training Corps,
mm-hmm.
which is a military type scene,
yeah.
Or you could belong to a street gang,
yeah.
or you could belong to a police-sponsored car club,
mm.
or you could join a rock and roll band, or you could be on the football team, you mm. know, and the only thing that appealed to the guys that I hung around with was to form a band, even though we weren't really excellent mm. musicians or anything.
And what sort of material would they be doing, covers of?
Well, we had 10 songs that we knew real good.
Mm.
And I'd say half of them were covers of rhythm and blues classics. I mean, records that had already, that were already 5 or 6 years old in 1955.
Mm.
We played Behind the Sun,
mm.
and we played Okie Dokie Stomp, and we played Bacon Fat, which was fairly recent at that time, and Kansas City. And then the rest of the evening was filled out with, oh, we did Directly From My Heart to You by
you,
Little Richard.
You were a vocal group then?
No, it was a band.
Was
See, in those days you had a band. And if you had a vocal group, it was extra added attraction. But the main thing was to have a band that could produce the kind of music that a teenager could dance to, because there was no other means by which to motivate that sort of social conduct other than playing records, you know, and that didn't get it off. So we were the only rhythm and blues rock and roll band within a million mile radius out there in the desert. There was just nothing up there. Mm. No, none of the big acts ever came up from L.A., so we just had the market corner.
You never cut? Did you ever cut?
No, the Blackouts never made it. Right.
Did you try and sort of sign?
No. I don't know why. We just never did. I made some home tapes of it, but I don't have them anymore. There's a couple of pretty good shuffles that we got into.
Yeah, there's a thing with the shuffle beat.
Yeah.
What did you do anything that you consider important to yourself in between that time and going to Cucamonga and starting a studio? Anything you feel you should mention?
Well, I changed over from playing the drums to playing the guitar when I was 18.
You were playing drums with the Blackouts?
Yeah.
When did you form this studio in Cucamonga? Let's talk about that a bit.
Cucamonga was the tail end of 1963.
What was this studio like?
Yes, it was an L-shaped room. I don't know the exact dimensions, but I have a contract in that drawer someplace, which is the bill of sale between me and Paul Buff.
Mm.
And the arrangement was that he was deeply in debt at the time that I took the thing over.
Yeah.
And I had just scored a cowboy picture.
What was that?
It was called Run Home Slow, and it starred Mercedes McCambridge, and I had received a couple of $1,000 for it. And Paul had already gotten a job working as Art LeBeau's engineer, and he more or less runs LeBeau's studio for him. And so I had arranged to record my soundtrack at Original Sound, and so as we got to talking about how much money I had made for doing the thing, and we arrived at a deal whereby I would take over his debts for $1,000, and in the process I would receive two pianos, one of them a baby grand, the other one a Steinway upright, and all the physical improvements on the premises, take over his lease, and take all the equipment that was in the control room, which included a Presto deck that had been outfitted with a homemade set of 5-track recording heads. It by some special arrangement that he had slapped on there, you could record and play back in both quarter-inch mono and also on half-inch tape using this 5-track system. He had two separate ways to run the tape through it. And there was that machine and a Presto disc cutter, the board, which had its own little low-budget compressor, and
how many channels was it?
I think it was an 8-input board.
And did you have echo in this thing?
Yeah, we had a Hammond spring echo, and we had EQ. Pretty flexible, considering.
Yeah. And how did the mothers come about?
Well, I was set up for a bust by the San Bernardino County Vice Squad, who didn't quite understand my activities there at the studio. I was located across the street from a Holy Roller church. And Cucamonga is a town. It's very small and sort of closed-minded. My hair had been growing, and I was a little weird, and there was music coming out of that place 36 hours a day. And so they sent this guy in there to entrap me. And that's really a long, involved story, but I went to jail for a while, and when I got out, I had to give up the studio because they were going to widen the street and they were going to tear it down. I had fallen behind in the rent that I owed to the landlord.
Well, what date was this about? Can you pinpoint?
I don't know. Maybe April, March or April of 64. Something like that. So I was looking for something to get into, and I received a call from Ray, who had been working with a group at a local bar in Pomona called The Broadside, and he had been working with a group called the Soul Giants, and he had just had a fight with a guitar player in the group, and he was out there looking for a replacement. So I went down there and
I joined the band, and then after a while I said, well, look, why don't we try and do something, and do some original material, because we were playing Midnight Hour and all that other stuff. So I talked him into getting Weird, and we practiced in what was left of the studio for about a week before I abandoned it completely. And then we went searching all over the countryside for places to work. And it was really a difficult situation.
Just
because
the two of you.
No, it was me and Ray, Roy Estrada, Jimmy Carl Black, and at that time there was a sax player named Davey Coronado. So we wanted to do original material. Davey, who is the wise one of the band, knew the actual truth of the matter, which was if you play original material, you cannot work in a bar. You have to play somebody else's record and nobody wants to listen to you. And he was afraid of being out of work, so he quit the band. And he was right. We couldn't get a fucking job anyplace.
So did you handpick the original Mothers, or did they belong to the Soul Giants?
No, they were all in the Soul Giants at the time.
You just converted them.
Yeah.
And how did you come to record? Was the first album cut independently and then leased to Verve, or did MGM sign the group outright?
MGM signed the group sort of, I don't know, some sort of a gesture perhaps, because Herbie knew Tom Wilson and sort of dragged him away from some fun and merriment at this, he was at this club down the street from the Whiskey A Go-Go. He was at the Trip. We were working a replacement job or something at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And Herbie got Wilson to come down and listen to us. Prior to that, we had made some demos at Original Sound, had sent them to MGM and a bunch of other companies, and we had been turned down by everybody in the business. And so MGM was sort of like a last resort. And we hadn't received any word as to the acceptance of our demos from MGM, so Herbie knew that Wilson was the guy to talk to. Saw Wilson in this club and made him come down and listen to us at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
That night.
Right.
Yeah.
Wilson comes in while we're doing the Watts Riot song, you know, which is a blues-type number. And most of the rest of the material that we had sent on the demos was not particularly strange or outrageous in any way. So nobody knew what was going to happen. So he heard the group on stage and just figured that it was a blues band.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, we'll sign him for the grand sum of $2,500 in advance. So we discussed the plans for making the album, and I told him I wanted to do some orchestration and so on and so forth, and he agreed to that. Next thing we knew, we're in the studio after, well, it took about 2 months from the time that he saw us. And first tune that we cut was Any Way the Wind Blows. And the second tune that we cut was Who Are the Brain Police.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that one was on the tape, the eyebrows started going up and down, and people were saying, what is this? What did we buy? And there was a series of rather excited phone calls from Los Angeles TTG Studios back to New York saying, what's going on here? In the first day.
And including It Can't Happen Here, was that done at that station?
No, Can't Happen Here was done on a Sunday afternoon.
So really, you got signed on false pretenses?
Well, I didn't warrant the group to be, a blues band. That's somebody just jumped to the conclusion after hearing one tune.
So how did such a large corporation react to an idea? Eventually they had to, they signed you, so they had to accept it.
Well, it was not only a question of having accepted this, but they had already spent $21,000 on this album. And so they had a bulk of material, more than they could stick in a single album, and I suggested that I would take a cut rate on the publishing, and they would release a double album on this unknown group, which was definitely a first in the biz. And then we gave them some merchandising suggestions on how to make this particular type of music reach the type of audience that would probably enjoy it. And so they started going along with it, and I thought everything was going to be cool with MGM until the execution of my ideas regarding the advertising and the merchandising of the product started getting ignored, and they started throwing in some of their own things, which were just so wrong. They had an advertising agency that must have been in a time capsule from 1940, you know.
What's the name?
Oh, man. One of the ads that they made up for one of our albums, in order to make it sound really cool, said, "It's the Bananas." Believe it or not, and they placed that as a full, as a color ad on the back page of Evergreen Review.
Yeah.
That was an ad for absolutely free. And the initial promotion on Freak Out as an album consisted of bumper stickers that said Susie Cream Cheese, and had, I mean, they were lacking in charm as far as a bumper sticker would go, because the logo of the company was so big.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't in at all. I mean, it was all really schlocky.
Mm-hmm.
And they could, yeah, well, it had Verve, you know, and a big circle and all that shit. And it just looked like an ad, and who wants to stick an ad on the back of their car? But if they would have done it right, it would have been a good campaign. The other thing that they did was they sent out a puzzle, piece by piece, which was a puzzle made out of the cover of the Freak Out album that was sent out to disc jockeys.
Mm-hmm.
As if that would really motivate him, you know. A guy gets one piece in the mail every day for a week, you know, so what's he going to do? Just foam at the mouth until he's got them all and put it together. And they also had buttons, which said Susie Cream Cheese and Mothers of Invention or something.
How much bread did it take to make that first album, 21,000?
It was about 21,000 production on the album, and they spent about $5,000 promotion, which I think is a very bad business judgment on their part to match in such a heavy investment on the album. So within the first year or so of release, the album had sold only about 30,000 copies, and they were not excited about our group. They thought we were a stiff group. And time came for us to record our second album. They really clamped down on the budget and everything, and they tried to get the thing out for 25 cents. Whereas in the Freak Out album, I had a certain amount of latitude, and I could experiment and, you know, really do things that I thought were interesting.
If it was so dubious, how come you got such a large budget?
Well, see, what happened was, Wilson had been given a block of money by the company to spend for all the albums that he produced.
At his disposal.
Right. So he got into the studio, and the thing just kept getting more and more intriguing, and he got interested in it, and so he was sticking his neck out.
And how spontaneous was the Mother's music? I mean, some of it, like the Rebirth of the Pumpkin thing, is obviously improvised, but does this technical nature of the music require that it's carefully rehearsed and planned, you know?
Not only is the music carefully rehearsed, but the group learns to perform the edits that you hear in an album. The group learns to perform those by following signals that I give them on stage with my hands.
So it's cut and dried for
me. No, it's not cut and dried. These signals are extremely variable. In other words, we can play any song in the middle of it, if I stick out three fingers like that. Hi, Dweezil.
Excuse me, I just want to check. Do you still want to go?
Yeah, what time is it?
It's getting light. I went to look at that club, but it's not working yet.
Quarter past nine.
Yeah.
What time is it? Do we have to be there?
10:15. And it's in Westwood. I'm not quite sure where it is.
Well, why don't you call and find out where it is and get all the details together. And it's quarter past nine now?
Yeah.
We're probably still going to have to leave by
9:30.
9:35.
Okay. But for instance, if I give a signal like this, I show them three fingers and then bring it down like that, several things happen. The organist lays his arms on the keys, making this rumble, and the drums do a thunderous roll, and the intensity with which that thunderbolt-type sound strikes is governed by the force with which I bring my hand down. In other words, I can show them three fingers like that and go whap like that and get an explosion. I can show them three and go down like this, and the initial attack is very soft on it, and I can build it up like a volcano.
Just like a conductor.
Yeah. So I had been conducting the group since the thing was formed. It's just that the type of sounds that we decided to incorporate into our vocabulary got more and more dissonant up until 1969, when the original group broke up.
And this isn't a studio you're talking about now.
Any place. I can conduct it any place.
But you use it in the studio?
Yeah, sure.
Could you please run through the personnel of the Mothers, since
I don't know whether I can remember them all. The after the Davy Coronado quit the group, mm-hmm. there was a group, a girl in the group named Alice Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
She was a folk singer, and she was very good. She played guitar. But we had to let her go because she couldn't play Louie Louie. And we had more requests for that song than anything else. And then there was Steve Mann, who was in for a couple of days until he bombed out on Reds at a rehearsal. Henry Vestine.
Yeah.
And
what did Kim Fowley have to do with it?
Kim Fowley happened to be at the recording session, and he's credited on the album with performance on Hypophone, which is his voice. He happened to be rapping at the session, exhorting the freakers who were in attendance.
Yeah.
And you know, just carrying on. See, Jim Garcia was in the Mothers for a while. Elliot Engbert.
What sort of background musically did the Mothers have, some of these musicians?
Ray was a carpenter, Roy was a truck driver, and Jim used to work for the electric company in Texas.
But were they jazz musicians?
No.
They were just amateurs, you could say.
Yeah.
So they never cut, really, or sort of been involved?
Ray was the only one.
Very surprising, actually. Well, that Reuben and the Jets album is a pretty good replica of some of the sounds of the 50s, right?
Yeah.
How did you have to go to any length with Val Valentin, you know, to work out the sort of sound technique?
Val Valentin has nothing to do with any of our albums.
He doesn't?
No, even though his name's on there. See, he's the director of engineering for the company. That doesn't mean he comes
in. He just masters them.
He does. I don't even know if he masters. So the engineering on Reuben and the Jets was done by Dick Kunk. And
did it take long to work out the sort of sounds to emulate those early rock recordings?
Mm-mm. No, because I already knew most of the techniques, you know, either from interviews with people who had actually done it,
mm-hmm.
or from... Well, I talked to Johnny Otis when I was in high school. I went down and saw his studio on a field trip one day with a few of the guys from the Blackouts. And
where did he have his studio?
I think it was on Washington Boulevard. It was Dig
Records. Records, yeah.
And I saw his echo chamber, which was a cement room. Yeah, and he was into overdubbing and a lot of that stuff, even in the early days. And he gave us a bunch of records and talked about the business. And
did he influence you in any way, has he?
Oh yeah, I've always liked the things that he'd done, especially when he was on Peacock.
Mm.
And I dug him as a disc jockey because I liked the records that he played. I thought he had pretty good taste for rhythm and blues.
Mm.
I didn't always agree with the collection of records that I would hear on Hunter Hancock's show. He was the other big R&B disc jockey. I dug Johnny's approach better.
Can you tell me if you had to go to any amusing degree to retire the studio equipment and sound for those Rubin?
Well, we compress things beyond belief for a lot of that stuff. I mean, like the sound of the drums, there's hardly anything left of them. They sound like oatmeal boxes. Yeah. We squashed
there's
them
no
and squeezed
bass,
them.
There's no bass, is there either? Did you deliberately sort of...
We, after we got the bass on there, I mean, there's a lot of bass in the mix. It's just that the bass tone has been clipped off, and the highs have been reinforced. It gives a little bit more scratchy sound to it.
Would you say, more modestly, that you were the sort of catalyst, the ideas man for the Mothers, and they were just sidemen on the record, carrying out your ideas?
Well, they executed my ideas, but the ideas were designed around their personalities, in other words.
And their potential.
Yeah, it was like custom tailored to their whole mythology.
Mm.
And I think that for anybody who's going to lead a band, that's the best thing to do with the people who are performing the music, you know, if you're doing original stuff. If you have the opportunity to write for a specific player, I mean, that's the greatest thing in the world.
Mm.
I mean, there are things that Jimmy Carl Black could never do on the drums, but I would always make sure that each time I gave him a part, I would try and push his technique a little farther so that he would, you know, gradually come along. When he first joined when we first started rehearsing stuff for the Freak Out album, he could just barely play the drum break in Any Way the Wind Blows.
Mm.
Which just happens to be a 6-beat bar instead of a 4-beat bar. It threw him off, just messed him up for 2 weeks.
Mm.
And by the time he was finished playing with the Mothers, he was playing in 5-8 and 7-8, following signals just like he was an orchestra musician.
So he learned quite a bit in that short time.
And it's the same is true of all the rest of the guys. You know, like I learned a lot about arranging.
from having a like a lab band to work with.
Mm.
Because if I imagined a sound, I could test it out right away by saying, you know, just you play this for a minute and you play that.
So they were your house band, almost.
Yeah.
I'm a great admirer of Captain Beefheart. Yeah. So should we just talk about him for a while? And
good.
When did you first meet him?
I met him about 1956.
56? Yeah. And what was he doing then? Tell me, I'll let you wrap.
He was in high school. Yeah. He was about to drop out of high school because his father was ill and he was going to take over his bread truck route to Mojave, driving a Helms bread truck.
Yeah.
And he lived at home with his mother, and his grandmother lived across the street. And he liked rhythm and blues records. He did not have a large collection of them, but he had quite a few nice ones.
Yeah, he was like you in that respect.
Yeah, well, he was the only guy I knew in town at that time that had an interest in rhythm and blues.
Mm.
Later, I met a couple of other guys, but we weren't as good friends as Beefheart.
Mm.
So he spent most of his time, money, and effort in driving around the desert in a powder blue Oldsmobile with a terracotta werewolf head that he had modeled himself, mounted underneath the plastic thing in his, he's either in his dashboard or underneath the blower of his horn on his steering wheel.
Yeah.
And he was very fond of wearing khakis and French-toed shoes and dressing in the latest pachuco fashions.
What was that? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a certain style of clothes that you had to wear to look like that type of teenager. You know, you had what you call a Sir Guy shirt, which is a certain brand of shirt, certain type of ugliness that you wore buttoned all the way up to your neck with a St. Christopher medallion on a chain outside the shirt.
Yeah.
You wore a white t-shirt underneath the Sir Guy shirt. You wore khakis, which had large cuffs, I mean, large belled things down like that with little slits on the side, and you wore squared off pointed toe shoes.
Was this hip, very hip?
No, it was Mexican hip.
Mm-hmm.
And the white kids were into black peggers and Levi's.
Yeah.
And he also had a fondness for cosmetics, like his mother sold Avon products.
Mm. She was just a salesman, you mean?
Yeah, she went door to door with these lotions and perfumes and stuff. And one time he poured some Avon cologne on his hair before going out.
Yeah.
Thought it smelled great, and his hair started falling out, and he broke out in a horrible rash, and he had to move away from the desert to stay with his aunt in East L.A. until it cleared up.
Was this in Lancaster when you referred to the desert?
Yeah.
Did he have any musical intentions at the time? Was he musically inclined?
He used to sing along with the radio whenever there was anything good on.
Did he have that gravelly voice
then? Yeah, he did, and that's one of the reasons why I've been after him for years to record. I said, you know, how can you waste it? It's too good to just drive around in an Oldsmobile grunting with a radio in the background. But he just didn't have the self-assurance to get into it.
But when you say he didn't have any sense of timing, how come he's done so well? Because some of his records are very rhythmic. Well, a lot of them, you know, but just very rhythmic.
Well, it has improved. Definitely has improved. But when he first started off doing it, his sense of timing was definitely into the minus zero.
Has he any idea in what direction he's going? Because he sort of flits between really freaky stuff into a straight delta blues. And what does
I don't
he want
know.
To
I haven't seen him for about 8 or 9 months. He doesn't like me anymore. He's, I don't know what he's doing now.
Had he cut anything before you did those demo things with him? Like?
Oh, the only things that he had cut was some tapes where I had conned him into doing a parody of a rhythm and blues vocal in one of the classrooms at the junior college. We borrowed a tape recorder from the school and recorded a song called Lost in a Whirlpool about a guy who's been flushed down the toilet by his girlfriend and is confronted with a blind brown fish. And
what was that a parody of?
Oh, well, it was just a parody of the idiom, not any particular song. And we also did a parody on, at the same date, we did a parody of The Search for Bridie Murphy. Do you know that?
No.
The story about the girl who gets hypnotized and taken back, and she supposedly remembers
a life before the life that she's living now, yeah, and documents it all, yeah, yeah, and goes through all these scenes. And so we did a parody on that where this guy is being hypnotized, and his voice, while he's being hypnotized, the voice is played by one of the school teachers named Jerry Ulberg, who has a very nice white suburban sort of voice.
Yeah.
And as he goes farther and farther back, he becomes Tom Dooley, and it turns out that Tom Dooley is is a very you know, sort of jivey negroid shoeshine boy or something. I don't know what kind of rendition Bleed is giving to it, but it's a funny concept, and it tells about how Tom Dooley gets hung because he was fucking some pie.
Well, Herbie could probably give you some interesting insights into what happened when we tried to get him into the studio for the to make Trout Mask. First of all, I had some discussions with him about 6 or 8 months prior to the recording of the album, and there was a whole bunch of contractual hassles that had to be straightened out before we even got him in the studio. All right, well, anyway, there was this really bizarre, confused thing with these contracts where some guy had stolen some masters and then validated something. And so we had discussed how and where we were going to make this album. Meanwhile, he had been rehearsing his group for about 12 months, 18 months.
Where was your husband?
In his house, which was out in Woodland Hills. And he kept him in the house, kept the members of the group isolated from the outside world. I mean, they were so poor they hardly had enough gas to go anyplace, but he made them rehearse every day for, you know, 10 hours a day, going over the same charts. And the reason why they had to do that is because of the way the material was written. He made various members of the group follow him around and write down everything that he said. So he was converting them into secretaries. And they would transcribe his thoughts, and then one guy would type them up. And then he would sit down at the piano with a cassette machine, and he would bang out anything that came into his mind on the piano. Then the cassette, he would say, okay, that's the song. And he would give the cassette to the guys and say, learn how to play this. Well, he doesn't play the piano in the normal fashion. So the problems come up that he may lay his hand on a bunch of notes that don't mean a guitar chord. And the only way to play that on a guitar is to tune the guitar a weird way or to invent some fingerings for the chord that never happened before. So if you have really professional guitar players working with you, you might be able to do it in a reasonable length of time, but the guys that he had there were all just, you know, beginners.
Really? Not bad.
Well, bad. It was good because their whole technique was shaped by what he asked them to do. In other words, he had an electric bass player that plays with finger picks, like claws, to get a special sound out of the bass that nobody else uses.
But was that B-part, the instigation, or was the guy using the picks anyway?
No, B-part asked him to do it. And the same with the other techniques. He wanted the guitars to sound a certain way and so on and so forth. So he would make the pieces up in layers. After he had banged out the thing on the piano, and they were supposed to learn that on the two guitars and the bass, he would invent a drum part that the drummer would have to master. Sometimes this would bear no relationship rhythmically to the other track. And then he would superimpose the words on the whole thing.
At random, almost.
Well, you know, wherever you could squeeze them in against a track like that.
Wow.
See, but the other thing that held it up was the fact that he had no PA system to work with out there. And in order to get the proper sound out of the guitars, they had to be up at a high volume, so there was no way he could sing over it. So he always had the excuse that, well, I didn't get a chance to practice the vocal part, you know, because the band wouldn't let me. You know, I got that version from him several times.
Friday after this.
We went into the studio to record the album, and the group recorded 20 tracks in 5 hours, doing some of them 5 times in a row, and I couldn't tell the difference between any of them.
Is that good?
Well, they had them so rehearsed. You know, he would say, well, there's something wrong with that, but I couldn't tell. I mean, the drum parts were exact, you know, and even though the things sounded like they're all tumbling and jumbled up, that was what he had told them to play, and they played it to the best of their ability.
Where did you cut this?
It
some of the material was recorded at the house, and some of it was, most of it was done at Whitney Studios in Glendale.
Did you have any problems in the studio? Just routine?
No, the only problems were Beefheart's paranoia, because at one point in the thing, I forget what it was. We had some kind of argument about the production of the album, and then that just blew over in a day or so. And he came in and put the voices on. It took 4 days to put the voices on, as opposed to 5 hours for all the tracks. A lot of the voices were put on by. He wouldn't even wear earphones. He stood out in the studio and sang. No. He could just barely hear the leakage through the window. In fact, sometimes he kept on singing and there wasn't any track anymore. He didn't even know where the track was because he couldn't keep in time with it.
Why did he do that? I mean,
it's the way he wanted to do it. So, you know, it's his music. I should tell him he should do it another way. So he sang those things, and when he went too far past the length of the track, we just cut off some of the things that he said.
Okay. Did he have these written lyrics in front of him when he was singing on the stand?
Yeah.
He did that.
Yeah. You know the cut on there called the blimp?
Yeah.
You know how that was done? I got a... He was in the habit of calling me or anybody else whose phone number that he happened to have, calling up in the middle of the night to read him the lyrics to a new song. Hmm. So I happened to be in the studio working on Burnt Wing Sandwich for the Mothers, and I was doing some mixing. And he had already called me 3 times during the session, and you know, just kept me on the phone for 15 minutes at a whack. You know, I'd spent almost $100 worth of studio time listening to his worries about when he was supposed to come into the studio the following day. So the final time, he gets on the phone, and he's got Jeff Cotton, otherwise known as Antenna Jimmy Simmons, on there. Jeff is telling me that I have to listen to this new song, which is, you know, the greatest in the world. So I arranged very quickly to set a microphone on the telephone. And the first piece of tape, which happened to be available, was an 8-track master in an unused section. In an unused section of a Mothers of Invention tune that was called Charles Ives. And that's what the background music is. That's the Mothers playing, not Beefheart's band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, so I just... The synchronization between the words and the track were completely random because he couldn't hear on the telephone any of the track. Cause
did
it
just use a spare track on the 8-track master?
Yeah, I didn't have time to set up another reel of tape or anything like that. So we just fed the output of the microphone, which is by the receiver, into the 8-track and stuck it on that one thing. And then we mixed it down later, and it just happened to work out. Including that little horn call that Beefheart is doing in the background. He's standing behind Jeff in the house, playing in just the right key to match up with the track, and nobody had any idea what was going on.
Ago, a funny-looking man with a question mark-shaped body, a hooked nose, a drooping mustache, and an evil goatee did an interview with a nice, clean, wholesome, attractively mod rock and roll interviewer person. Funny Frank Zappa mentioned in passing that one day in the future there was going to be a movie about the Mothers of Invention. The hip and intelligent rock and roll writer person laughed. He said, "The Mothers of what? All the fashionable feather bead and headband people who read the hip and intelligent rock and roll writer person's article laughed. All the groovy people agreed there will never be such a movie. Who needs it?" Then one day, when nobody was looking, this mysterious movie came out, and along with it came a soundtrack album, the likes of which had never been imagined before. The soundtrack album from Frank Zappa's 200 Motels. A deluxe double album featuring the Mothers of Invention, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra of London, an amazing classical chorus, a 16-page book of scenes from the movie itself, and a giant full-color theater poster. Frank Zappa's 200 Motels. It's available now from United Artists. Now there's a company with guts.
He plays the bicycle, and his name is Frank Zappa.
Thank you.
You actually play a bicycle?
Yeah.
Are you in the Musicians Union?
No.
Do you play any other musical instrument, anything more conventional, perhaps?
Guitar, vibes, bass, and drums.
Guitar, vibes, bass, drums, and bicycle. As bicycle, we'll travel from his bass to his drums to his guitar. How did you happen to pick up your first bicycle?
I was discussing this before with some of the people backstage. I believe that a lot of the people have actually played bicycles from time to time. But when they're young, they take a piece of cardboard and a clothespin, attach it to the rear wheel, and then it goes around, it makes that noise, and you're playing a bicycle then.
Oh, I see. You mean when they pretend they have a little motor and make it sound like a motorbike? Yes, we've all done that. Well, is that what you do? You make a motorbike noise? I see a couple of bikes over here. Perhaps we'd better go over and demonstrate and show them what you do. Frank Zappa, Z-A-P-P-A, huh? Well, here we are, friends, stereo bikes. How long have you been playing bike, Frank?
About 2 weeks.
He probably was selling insurance or something, and he thought, what's something real jerky that'll get me on the Steve Allen show? Playing bicycle, what could be sillier than that? And he did it, and here we are. That's probably how it happened. You really only been playing 2 weeks?
Yes.
What do you do ordinarily besides this?
I'm a composer.
Ah. And might we be familiar with any of your songs as yet?
Well, you will be familiar with some of my songs as of next week. But I did the score for The World's Greatest Sinner. The...
and who might that be? Tommy Manville or who? Tell us about that.
That's the name of the film. It's The World's Worst Movie, and I did the music for it.
The World's Greatest Sinner?
Yes. It's a Tim Carey production, Frenzy Productions.
Frenzy Productions.
It's an independent company.
They all are these days, the way things are going. But,
they shot at Mel Monte.
So they shot my agent, Mel Monte. You know, that could happen to anybody. Who's in it?
Tim Carey and a cast of 1,000 people that he found down on Main Street somewhere.
The world's greatest sinner. Well, we'll look forward to that. Now, as for the job of the moment, you want to play the New Departure Blues, or exactly what are you going to play on this here? I'll just let you show us what happens.
The first thing that I should do is demonstrate to you the different types of sounds that you can get from a bicycle, because it actually does make some very interesting sounds, and of course, that's what we're all interested in.
Is new sounds, yes. Like...
That's one of the sounds that you can make.
Yes. Oh, you have a microphone down there, I see.
Well, I'll need this microphone to pick up the next sound. It's a, you have to hold it right there.
All right. Hello? I'm sorry, you'll have to leave a message. He's not here right now. That's pretty good. Oh, there's a hole in these things, isn't there?
Yes.
Were you just whistling through there?
No,
you tried.
Blow air.
You just blow air and did it whistle? Can I blow air and a little whistle? Try this on your own.
Okay, now here's what else you can do. You can pluck the spokes like a harp.
Sounds like the Kyoto of Japan. I can play my nose. Hey, do that again. I mean that other thing.
Thank you. Ben, as I was demonstrating before, you can run the sticks over the spokes in rapid motion. This produces the
spoke stick.
It's similar to the effect of the cardboard and cloth gun.
The steel drums of Jamaica and Trinidad.
You can also bang on the frame, and if you're lucky enough to have a bicycle that has a squeaking seat, you can squeak the seat.
Exploding handlebar, you can explode the handlebar. Premises granted, there's no limit to what you can do.
This may be a little bit new to you, but I think that...
It doesn't come up in the ordinary conversation.
I should suggest you alternate between Boeing and trucking.
An Aerojet. These are two airplanes here today.
And pluck it, and if you can scratch across the
basket.
The basket, yeah. Now, the whole idea that we're going to do here in this improvised concerto for two bicycles, a pre-recorded tape, and the musicians in the back, is that you're supposed to express yourself freely without any kind of, you have to let your front down, and... You're completely released. You're a composer yourself, and you know that the standard method of notation is very difficult, you know. And
I ignore it.
Yeah. Well, this will help. Now,
you write the music on a road map for this thing. That's how Route 66 was written. You think I'm kidding? I am kidding. Not too successfully. Can't go ahead.
But now, the way we work this is, when the man in the control booth feels moved to add his electronic part to our work here, he will throw a little switch, which just lets some of this noise through, and then I request of the musicians that if they feel so moved, make any noise possible on your instrument. No, try and refrain from musical tones. In fact, it would be possible for you to put some sort of objects on the strings of the piano, you'll get... That's good. I prefer you to play it that way.
All season long, Don.
Alright? Now, we'll start.
Cycle car on a seat in back of me. I took a bump at 95 and rode on ruthlessly. Say that I'm always in favor of enlarging the horizons, at least in peering anxiously beyond the horizons of any field of human endeavor or interest, and therefore I congratulate you on your farsightedness. And as for your music, don't ever do it around here again. No, seriously, it was a very amusing and entertaining and stimulating experiment. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Yes, I would. Next week, his record is being released called How's Your Bird?
Really?
Yes. I brought a dub of it over here. I don't think you've heard it yet. And it's going to buy it. It's wonderful.
Crazy.
Everything but a bicycle.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Zappa. Thank you.
What's your name?
I'm Martin Hickman.
And where is your position here?
Front office manager.
The name of this establishment is?
This is the Edgewater Inn.
It's Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how some rock and roll groups have taken advantage of this unique situation?
They've taken advantage in different ways. We do encourage and advertise that you can fish from your room, and we are glad to have our guests fish from them.
Do you supply them with fishing equipment?
No, but we have a shop in the hotel that does rent the equipment as well as bait.
What sort of bait do they usually use?
It's a preserved minnow of some variety. I don't know exactly what the fish is.
Well, what do they do after they fish from the window?
Well, rock and roll bands and other guests as well often catch shark and squid and octopus, and usually it lands up either in the bathtub or dribbled on the floor on the way to the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not reserved to any rock and roll bands. I mean, other guests do it too.
Mm-hmm. But how frequently do you find squids and sharks and octopuses in the bathtubs of the rooms here at the hotel?
After almost any good weekend of pretty heavy occupancy, say like over half the house filled.
If you have over half the house filled, you would find one, say?
Say one or so.
So how often would you say that is each week? Twice a week you find a...
Well, I don't know that I would say that it would average anything like that. You may find four or five rooms with fish from various places, you know, around. There's not much you can do with a shark after you've caught him, you know. Some of these things are pretty big.
Well, what would you imagine is done with these sharks after they've been caught, before they're left for you to be cleaned
Sometimes
up?
The guest calls the houseman or housekeeper to haul it away because there's nothing that they can do with it.
Yeah, well, have you ever heard of any of the things that were done with them before they were hauled away?
Yes, some people like to perform vivisection on them or something like that, and occasionally you find a little bit of a mess.
Yeah.
I'll say that the blood on the carpet syndrome is rather rare, but it occasionally happens.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find fish blood on the sheets of your beds here?
Not identifiable as such, no.
I see. Do you know of any stories about bizarre sexual activities performed with squid, octopus, and mud sharks here in your rooms?
No, I should think a mud shark would be a little uncomfortable since their skin is so sandy, but I've never heard of anyone having it with an octopus.
Can you tell about what happened with John and Yoko in the Fillmore?
Yes, I can tell you very specifically what happened with John and Yoko at the Fillmore. I was scheduled to do an interview with Howard Smith from a radio station in New York. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I was awakened out of bed in my hotel room, came stumbling to the door in my pants with my hair in my eyes and all kinds of little sleep dust. And I'm going, oh God, another interview. And I open the door, and here's Howard standing at the door with a tape recorder already flailing away, and stuffs a microphone in my face and says, "Hi, Frank, I brought along two friends of mine. This is John and Yoko." And I was supposed to go eek and stumble backwards in a blind stupor. But I said, "Okay, you guys, come on in." So they walked in and sat down and, you know, started doing this interview and blah and blah and interview and blah and blah and blah. And then finally, when the interview was over, I said, "Would you guys like to jam with us tonight at the Fillmore?" And John said, well, he didn't think that he would, but Yoko was positive that she would. And so I said, "Well, okay, Yoko, you know, come on down and come down a little early, and you know, come in the dressing room, and we'll figure out something that we can do that will musically relate after the concert." So we sat around in this little room upstairs and played some old rhythm and blues stuff for a while, and then they went out and sat in the sound mixer's booth throughout the show, and I guess they liked it a lot, because when the thing was over, they both ran down. They were ready to go on as soon as we went off. So we played for about 40 minutes, I guess, and it just so happened that we had made arrangements to record that night. That's when, the same night we did the Fillmore album, and the whole thing got laid down on tape. And John and I had an agreement that we were going to jointly mix the tape and decide how we were going to put it out, you know, because there are big contract difficulties involved in getting the thing out. So it sat around for a while, I guess about a year, and there was nothing done about releasing it. Finally, I got word that John was going to release it, and that some negotiation was going to be worked out. But that negotiation never occurred. As a matter of fact, he went in, I'd sent him a safety copy of the 16-track masters, and I guess he went in with Phil Spector and mixed the thing with this ridiculous tape delay echo on it. He turned off Mark and Howard's voices on the section called Scumbag, and they were the only ones who were really singing on it, and you can't even hear them on their version of the thing. I have a mix of the thing too. You wouldn't even recognize the two events. And you know, they did weird things like put in certain applause where it didn't really occur, and you know, they changed the thing around. And then the ultimate insult was to take the tune King Kong, which was obviously an ensemble performance, you know, where everybody and the mothers knew what they were playing. They were playing the melody. It was obviously a song. You know, if it had been a situation where I was mixing the thing, I would say, well, that's obviously a song. What is the name of that song, and who has the writing and publishing on that? Well, it didn't occur in their case. They retitled King Kong Jam Rag, took the publishing and writing credit, and put that on the album that way. You know, so consequently, there was a number of very irate phone calls between our office and Alan Klein, and you know, a bunch of show business crap like that. Anyway, that's the story of the Fillmore album.
Frank Zappa on Electric Tongue on KMET in Los Angeles.